If you have your copies of scriptures, I'm going to invite you to turn with me to 2 Samuel chapter 8. We are talking today about David the warrior. Last week we talked about David the worshiper. And this week we want to take some opportunity to look at what it was that made David a successful warrior. Joshua, the great leader at the beginning of the nation of Israel, when they first came into the land, spent 40 years doing nothing but trying to conquer the land. And he engendered a lot of people to follow him, and he was able to accomplish great things. But in all the time that he spent traveling around the land and never really taking possession of his own property, just helping the Israelites to possess the land, Joshua never got hold of the whole territory that God had promised to the nation of Israel, that God had given to Abraham way back when Abraham was a nomad living in tents, a Bedouin, if you will, living in tents and raising sheep in southern Israel. And then came the time of the judges, and the time of the judges was a period of time that someday I really want to take some time to preach on, because it's a downward spiral. After Joshua came Caleb. Caleb was 80 years old, and he looked at the area that had the greatest enemies in the land, the giants, and he said, I want that mountain, 80 years old, ready to take it for God. And after Caleb, the people forgot to follow God, and pretty soon they were overtaken by enemy. And then after they were overtaken by the enemy, then they called out to God again, and God delivered them, and they followed God under judge after judge after judge. But what happened was this. The Israelites started out up here following God. And then they started down a spiral, kind of like following a spring from the top to the bottom. And it was a cycle. It started out with following the judge, forsaking God, being under a period of domination, then being delivered by God, and following God again, but never quite getting back up to the level that they were before. So it became a downward spiral for 400 years in the nation of Israel, following judge after judge after judge. Then the people cried out and they said, we want a king. And so God gave them a king. The king's name was Saul. And Saul spent a good share of his time fighting wars in the land of Israel. Those wars included fighting the Philistines. And he constantly was at war with the Philistines. As a matter of fact, he spent most of his time and his life in battle, never able to conquer. Shortly after that, when Saul was killed, and his sons and his heads were hung on the gates of Bethshan, David came to power and became king. And David then enters into battle with the Philistines, the Moabites, the Edomites, and even the Syrians to the north. And we come to 2 Samuel chapter 8, and this is the period of time that we're talking about. David is now king. He has been in battle. And here's what it says. After this, it came to pass that David attacked the Philistines and subdued them. And David took Megathamah from the hand of the Philistines. And Megathamah, by the way, was the city of Gath. If you'll remember, David's first recorded battle that we have is against a soldier of Gath. His name is Goliath. And Gath was the city where Goliath's family was from. Now, Goliath was probably the largest of the large in the family. Somewhere, depending on how you measure a cubit, between 9 and 11 feet tall. That's big. And he was among an army or a family of giants that were killed by David and his men later on. And he defeated Moab, which is to the south and east of Israel. Forcing them down to the ground, he measured them off with a line, and two lines he measured off of those he put to death. and one full line of those he kept alive. So he took the Moabites and he literally killed two-thirds of them and kept one-third of them alive. So the Moabites became David's servants and brought tribute. Now, remember, the Moabites are the people from whom an ancestor of David, Ruth, came from. If anything, David should have felt a little bit of compassion towards him, don't you think? And yet what happened was Ruth, the ancestor of David, who was a Moabite, as she was leaving the land, what did she say to Naomi? Your people will be my people. Your God will be my God. Whether you go, I will go. And so she forsook all of them in order to become a Jewish proselyte and an ancestor of David. David also defeated Hadadezer, the son of Rehob, the son of Zobah, and he went to recover his territory at the river Euphrates. By the way, I don't care how many times you practice some of these names. Once you get in front of people, you stutter. Try that with Mephibosheth when you got a lisp. And so he went to recover his territory at the river Euphrates. Did you catch that? At the river Euphrates. So all the way over into Iraq and Iran, David had literally conquered north and east and south. David took from him 1,000 chariots, 700 horsemen, 20,000 foot soldiers, and also David hamstrung all of the chariots except those that he spared, enough of them for 100 chariots. When the Syrians of Damascus came to help Hadadezer, the king of Zobah, David killed 22,000 of the Syrians. Then David put garrisons in Syria of Damascus, and the Syrians became David's servants and brought tribute to the Lord. So the Lord preserved David wherever he went. And David took the shields of gold that belonged to the servants of Hadadezer and brought them to Jerusalem, also from Betah and from Berothai. And cities of Hadadezer and King David took a large amount of bronze. When Toi, king of Hamath, heard that David had defeated all the army of Hadadezer, then Toi sent Joram, his son, to King David to greet him and bless him because he had fought against Hadadezer and defeated him, for Hadadezer had been at war with Toi. And Joram brought with him articles of silver, articles of gold, and articles of bronze. And King David also dedicated these to the Lord, along with the silver and the gold that he had dedicated from all the nations which he had subdued, from Syria, from Moab, from the people of Ammon, from the Philistines, from Amalek, and from the spoil of Hadadezer, the son of Rehob, king of Zobah. And David made himself a name when he returned from killing 18,000 Syrians in the Valley of Salt, that is the area of the Dead Sea. And he also put garrisons in Edom throughout all Edom, which is down in the area of the Dead Sea. And he put garrisons, and all the Edomites became David's servants. And the Lord preserved David wherever he went. Now, here's what I want you to recognize. 400 years of fighting from Joshua to Samuel did not conquer a little strip of land about the size of New Jersey. Another 40 years of fighting under Saul, the great king, did not conquer a little strip of land about the size of New Jersey. And David came in and conquered the land from the Mediterranean Sea, south down to the Gulf of Aqaba, east over to the river Euphrates, which, by the way, was the forerunner to the Babylonian countries and the Babylonian Empire under Nebuchadnezzar. This Hadadezer here had to have been some kind of a forerunner, not necessarily an ancestor of his, but he was definitely a forerunner to Nebuchadnezzar. Where he was conquering was the area of Babylon, the area of Assyria that later would defeat the 10 tribes to the north, and then Babylon, which would defeat the two tribes to the south. And then he went all the way north into Syria and Damascus, and he had all of that area. And he went all the way back east to the Mediterranean Sea. David had conquered it all. Look back, if you will. Keep your finger there, but look back, if you will, to Genesis chapter 15. Genesis chapter 15. God has made a promise to Abraham. And here's what God says, verse 18. On the same day, the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I have given this land from the river of Egypt, that is, clear down into the Gulf of Aqaba, to the great river Euphrates, the Kenites, the Kenizzites, the Kadmonites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Rephaimites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Girgashites, the Jebusites, and all of the other parasites. And what that's saying is this. The land was going to belong to Abraham's descendants someday, and it was going to belong to Abraham's descendants all the way over the area of the land that David had just conquered. For the first time in Israel's history, over 500 years of history, in the land, Israel had what was promised to them for the first time. Why? Two statements are made here. I want to go back and I want to look at them, if you would, with me. In 2 Samuel chapter 8, verse 6, at the end of the verse, it says, so the Lord preserved David wherever he went. And then down in verse 14, and the Lord preserved David wherever he went. David's conquest was that he was the chosen king to recover all of the land of Israel for the Jewish people, and the Lord preserved David wherever he went. I have a question for you. Were the battles that David fought physical or spiritual? I submit to you that the battles that David fought were spiritual, that were played out in the physical. God preserved David in the physical because he did the right things in the spiritual. God allowed David to accomplish what he accomplished in the physical because David followed God with his whole heart. David was a man after God's own heart. Now, we know that David had problems and he had sins, and these things come into play in David's life. And they come into play in the form of defeat in the physical. But it starts out, David's conquest happens because David is spiritually following the Lord our God. And when we begin to really understand what that means, we begin to really understand the significance of David's life. Turn over with me to Psalm 2, if you would. Keep your finger in 2 Samuel chapter 8. We may go back there, but Psalm 2 says this. Why do the nations rage and a people plot a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us break their bonds in pieces and cast away their cords from us. This is a psalm that was written by David around the time of these conquests. He who sits in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall hold them in derision, and he shall speak to them in his wrath and distress them in his deep displeasure. Yet I have set my king on my holy hill in Zion. I will declare the decree. The Lord has said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will give the nations for your inheritance and the ends of the earth for your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall dash them to pieces like a potter's vessel. Now, therefore, be wise, O kings. Be instructed, you judges of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry, and you perish in the way. And when his wrath is kindled but a little, blessed are all those who put their trust in him. What's the point of this? The point of this is this. God says to David, I will give you everything that you need if you'll put your trust in me. It has nothing to do with how great a warrior David was. For every great warrior that comes along, there's someone that will come along who is greater. Remember the old westerns? You know, the aging cowboy, the gunfighter. He's faster than grease lightning, and he's there in the town, and he's ready to save the town, and every young buck that comes along is ready to take him on and try him out to see if he's as fast as the aging gunfighter. But in the back of the aging gunfighter's mind is always this thought: someday, somewhere, there's going to be somebody come along who's faster than me, and that's when I take the bullet. How did David conquer? Not because he was the greatest warrior, because he was the greatest follower of God. Look at verse 6, chapter 2, Psalm 2, verse 6. Yet I have set my king on the holy hill. I will declare the decree the Lord has said to me, you are my son, today I have begotten you. David took the claim and he said, I'm going to be who God has called me to be, the king of the holy hill, the hill of Zion, the hill that we know today as the Temple Mount of Jerusalem. Ask of me and I will give the nations for your inheritance and the ends of the earth for your possession. David claimed what God promised. David's conquest of the land was accomplished through the power of God. David was not the conqueror. God was. Even when it looks like we are in control of the situation, God is still sovereign. God's chosen king treated his once powerful enemies with derision. Look over into Psalm 60, if you would. Psalm 60, verse 6. God has spoken in his holiness. I will rejoice and I will divide Shechem and measure out the valley of Succoth, and Gilead is mine, and Manasseh is mine, and Ephraim also is the helmet for my head. Judah is my lawgiver. Moab is my washpot. Moab, the country that David, again, he wrote this psalm about this time, the country that David conquered, became the washpot, the servant of Judah, of David. Over Edom I have cast my shoe. What does that mean? That means this. One sign of fealty, one sign of slavery was when over the slave's head, the owner would take off his sandal, his shoe, and throw out the dust off of his shoe onto the head of the servant. That meant this person is my slave. That was one of the ways of indicating that this person is now my slave. And what David is saying here in Psalm 60 is, over Edom, over that great army that conquered our people time after time after time, back in the days of the judges, I am now taking my shoe off and I'm throwing the dust from my shoe on his head. I'm in control. I'm the king, and they will follow me. And he says, over Edom I have cast my shoe. Philistia, shout in triumph because of me. Not because of them, because of me. Who will bring me to the strong city? Who will lead me to Edom? Is it not you, O God, who cast us off? And you, O God, who did not go out with our armies? Give us help from trouble. From the help of man is useless. Through God we will do valiantly, for it is he who shall tread down our enemies. You know what the benefit of the Old Testament is? Time after time after time, we see example after example after example in the Old Testament of God going before the people in the physical when they follow him in the spiritual. Time after time. When Hezekiah and Jerusalem was surrounded by 185,000 Assyrians, they did not lift one finger to defeat that army. The angel of the Lord went out and defeated them. David, time after time after time, against all odds, somehow was able to conquer every enemy, not because of his own valiant effort, but because God will tread them under his feet. Which brings us to our second point. And that is Jesus' conquest. You see, the whole point of understanding David the warrior is to understand that David did not fight in his own power. He fought in the power of the Lord God Almighty. Look in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. If you would. 1 Corinthians chapter 15. I want to point out to you a passage here that shows Jesus' conquest for us. For 33 years in this life, in this world, Jesus came and he lived a physical life on the earth. Now, we have a tendency to look at the physical life and we tend to say this is the reality that we have, and we miss the reality of the spiritual because we are a physical being. But Jesus' conquest is this. Look in chapter 15, verse 53. For this corruptible must put on incorruption, this mortal must put on immortality. It doesn't really matter whether or not you're going to heaven or hell. When you die, you are going to have another body that is going to live on forever. You're going to have a soul and a spirit that will live on forever, and you will be either in torment or in the joy of the Lord. So when this corruptible is put on incorruption and this mortal is put on immortality, then shall be brought to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. O death, where is your sting? O Hades, where is your victory? The sting of death is sin, and the strength of the sin is the law. But thanks be to God, who gives us the victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Therefore, my beloved brethren, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that your labor is not in vain in the Lord. What is the conquest of Jesus? It is the fact that Jesus came as David did and conquered everything that God has promised to him. For David, it was the land from the Euphrates to the Mediterranean, from Syria all the way down to the Gulf of Aqaba. For Jesus, it was death and hell that was conquered. And Jesus conquered everything that God had set before him, not in the power of his might, but in the power of God. What's the point? The point is this, faith lesson number one. Our battles are not of this flesh and blood world. Time after time after time, I hear preachers trying to make that point with people. Our battles are not of this flesh and blood world. Look at Ephesians chapter 6, verse 12. For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities and against powers and against rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in heavenly places. Therefore, take up the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, having done all, to stand. Our battles are not against the flesh and blood world. Let me explain something to you. It's called the doctrine of expendability. Every soldier knows this doctrine. It's very simple. The reason that the soldier is on the front line is because he is expendable. The general moves to the back of the line, not because he's not willing to fight, but because he's already fought and his experience makes him indispensable. But the reason that the soldier, the foot soldier, is up there on the front line is because he is expendable. In the Church of Jesus Christ, we have come to the conclusion that everybody is indispensable, and we forget the fact that we are here on the front lines because Jesus put us here to be expendable, to be used for him. This is what Elton Trueblood says about the doctrine of expendability. When the doctrine of expendability is accepted by the church, it becomes at once obvious that, in contrast to many organizations, the church is not instituted for the benefit of its members. Did you catch that? The church has not been put here for the benefit of its members. Christ enlists ordinary men and women into his enduring fellowship, not primarily in order to save them, but because he has work for them to do. It is a genuine revelation that his primary call to commitment, come to me, is associated at once with a call to labor. Take my yoke upon you. The call to commitment, come to me, is associated with the labor. Take my yoke upon you. The church is essential to the Christian, not because it brings him personal advancement or even inspiration, but because, with all its failures, it is an indispensable instrument for the redemption of the world. Unquote. Our battles are not of this flesh and blood world. We are here to be expendable. We are here to be used of God to make a difference in a lost and dying world. The issue here is not whether or not we are comfortable, but whether or not the person that we are touching is going to heaven. And if that person is going to heaven, then we move on to the next person that is going to heaven, that needs to go to heaven. We are here to be used. The story is told about Jesus when he gets back to heaven. And Gabriel comes up to him and he says, "Lord, so what's your plan from here on out?" Jesus says, "Well, I left 11 guys behind and 120 people in a room. And my plan is for them to tell the world that I died for the world." Now, Gabriel didn't fall off the turnip truck yesterday. He knows people. So he said, "Lord, what's your backup plan?" Jesus said, "I have no backup plan. It's either these people or nothing." We are here not for our creature comforts. We were saved to accomplish the will of God on this earth. And the sooner that we, the church, begin to recognize that we are here not for our own natural needs and our own desires, but we are here to touch a lost and dying world for the sake of the gospel, it is then that we begin to recognize why God put us here in the first place. It wasn't to honor our father and mother, although that's part of honoring him. It wasn't to be a great intellect, although that's part of honoring God. It wasn't even to be a great orator or wonderful musicians or great with art or beauty or other things. We are here to serve him. Which brings us to faith lesson number two. The victory is already won in Jesus, but battles still need to be fought. The problem is that we fight the battles in the wrong places. We're asking all the wrong questions, fighting all the wrong battles in all the wrong locations, and the battle isn't even there. Sometimes I think Satan just stands back and laughs at the church because he's got us fighting these battles over here, and he's over here doing his dirtiest work. Let me give you a few examples. The Ethiopian church. In 1982, the Ethiopian Mennonite church numbered 5,000 people. Communism took over in Ethiopia in 1982, and the church had to go underground. They weren't allowed to sing hymns. They weren't allowed to do anything out loud for fear of being caught and immediately executed. That 5,000 people went underground, and in 1992, the communist regime was overthrown. When the communist regime was overthrown, the Mennonite leadership came into the country and decided that they would try to pull out the remnant of the church and do a combined get-together with them in order to encourage them. 500,000 people showed up who had been impacted by the Ethiopian Mennonite church in 10 years. In 10 years, they grew from 5,000 to 500,000. Now, here's what I want to ask you. Does it take a building to carry on the gospel of Jesus Christ? Does it take a free country to carry on the gospel of Jesus Christ? We cry about the fact that we can't have prayer in school. That by having prayer, by not allowing prayer in school, we're somehow holding back our rights. I submit to you that we are not using our rights as we should, because we are perfectly free to pray for every teacher, for every administrator, for every student in the comfort of our own home. And I submit to you that we often fight this battle of prayer in school so that we don't have to do it at home. And if we really care about the freedom for children, if we really care about bringing children to Jesus Christ, let's pray for them. If we really care about what people are being educated in the school system, let's pray for them. But let's quit playing these games of thinking that by bringing prayer back into school, that every teacher is somehow going to turn into a wonderful saint and stand up before their class every day and pray for them. It ain't going to happen. What we're going to do is we're going to get mantras and we're going to get yoga and we're going to get all kinds of other stuff introduced into the schools and to our children. I, for one, would rather be at home touching those people's lives through the power of God, because my battle is not in the flesh. It is against principalities and powers and rulers of wickedness in high places. David understood that. Jesus understood that. Paul understood that. The Church of Jesus Christ today does not understand that, because our creature comforts have taken over our heart. The victory is already won. It's already won. Let me give you an indicator of that. I talked to you a few weeks ago about now what prayers. And then it seemed that everything kind of fell loose from there. I want to read to you a story that I think you'll find enlightening. My son Gilbert was 8 years old and had been in Cub Scouts only a short time. During one of his meetings, he was handed a sheet of paper, a block of wood, 4 tires, and told to return home and give it all to Dad. That was not an easy task for Gilbert to do. Dad was not receptive to doing things with his son, but Gilbert tried. Dad read the paper, scoffed at the idea of making a pinewood derby car with his young, eager son, and the block of wood remained untouched as the weeks passed. Finally, Mom stepped in to see if I could help figure this all out. The project began. Having no carpentry skills, I decided it would be best if I simply read the directions and let Gilbert do the work. And he did. I read aloud the measurements, the rules of what we could do and what we couldn't do, and within days, his block of wood was turning into a pinewood derby car. A little lopsided, but looking great, at least through the eyes of Mom. Gilbert had not seen any of the other kids' cars and was feeling pretty proud of his blue lightning. The pride was that comes from knowing that you did something on your own. Then the big night came. With his blue pinewood derby car in his hand and pride in his heart, we headed to the big race. Once there, my little son's pride turned to humility. Gilbert's car was obviously the only car made entirely on his own. All other cars were a father-son partnership with cool paint jobs and sleek body styles made for speed. A few of the boys giggled as they looked at Gilbert's lopsided, wobbly, unattractive vehicle. To add to the humility, Gilbert was the only boy without a man at his side. A couple of the boys who were from single-parent homes at least had an uncle or a grandfather by their side. Gilbert had Mom. As the race began, it was done in elimination fashion, and you kept racing as long as you were the winner. One by one, the cars raced down to the finely sanded ramp, and finally, it was between Gilbert and the sleekest, fastest-looking car there. As the last race was about to begin, my wide-eyed, shy 8-year-old stopped to ask if he could stop the race for a minute because he wanted to pray. The race stopped. Gilbert hit his knees, clutching his funny-looking block of wood between his hands. With a wrinkled brow, he set to converse with his father, and he prayed in earnest for a very long minute and a half, and then he stood, smile on his face, and announced, "Okay, I'm ready." As the crowd cheered, a boy named Tommy stood with his father as their car sped down the ramp. Gilbert stood with his father within his heart and watched his block of wood wobble down the ramp with surprisingly great speed and rush over the finish line in a fraction of a second before Tommy's car. Gilbert leaped in the air with a loud thank you as the crowd roared in approval. The scoutmaster came up to Gilbert with a microphone in hand and asked the obvious question, "So you prayed to win, huh, Gilbert?" To which my young son answered, "Oh, no, sir. That wouldn't be fair. To ask God to help me to beat someone else, I just asked him to help me make it so I don't cry when I lose." Children seem to have a wisdom far beyond us. Gilbert didn't ask God to win the race. He didn't ask God to fix the outcome. Gilbert asked God to give him the strength in the outcome. When Gilbert first saw the other cars, he didn't cry out to God, "No fair, they had father's help." No, he went to his father for strength. Perhaps we spend too much time of our prayer time asking God to rig the race, to make us number one, or too much time asking God to remove us from the struggle when we should be seeking God's strength to get through the struggle. I can do everything through him who strengthens me. Gilbert's simple prayer spoke volumes to those present that night. He never doubted that God would indeed answer his request. He didn't pray to win, thus hurt someone else. He prayed that God would supply the grace to lose with dignity. Gilbert, by his stopping the race to speak to his father, also showed the crowd that he wasn't there without a dad, but his father was most definitely there with him. Yes, Gilbert walked away a winner that night with his father at his side. The problem in America today is not that we need to become a more Christian country. The problem in America today is not that we need to evangelize the president. A Christian White House will not change our country. Jack Kemp said, "The White House evangelized will make no difference in America. The difference will happen one heart at a time. We wrestle not against flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers and rulers of wickedness in high places." How can you pray? How can you use what God has given you to bring glory for him in the physical as you fight in the spiritual? H.G. Spafford was a wealthy businessman at the time of the Great Chicago Fire at the end of the last century. And when the fire had gone through and ravaged all of his possessions, he sent his family on a cruise to Europe and sent them to England for a few weeks. In the process of going to England, their ship went down. His four daughters were killed. His wife made it through, and when in England, she sent an urgent message to her husband. It said, "Saved alone." That was all it said. He had heard about the accident, and he knew that his daughters and his wife were on that ship. Immediately, he got a ticket and immediately started across the ocean to be with his wife. And as the captain shared with him that they were ready to pass over the watery grave of his daughters, Spafford went out on the deck and, praying to God, wrote these words: "When peace like a river attendeth my way, when sorrow like sea billows roll, whatever my lot, it is well with my soul."